I'll hang on to this, if you don't mind. He smiled. Security precaution.
Chapter 8. Kumar's shouts woke him from a very deep sleep. Mabbutt felt desperately tired. His bag, full of dirty laundry, lay beside him. He felt sticky and grubby, and he was sure he was beginning to smell. As soon as he'd emerged from his tent, Kumar and the younger boys moved in to dismantle it. Melville, who had found a freshly pressed kurta from somewhere, seemed positively energized by the lack of sleep. If he'd been discursive the previous night, there was no sign of it this morning. He was deep in discussion with Kinesh and Mahesh. Mabbutt went over behind the tree, peed, and cleaned his teeth. Anything more elaborate would have to wait till later. When he came back, Melville was at the table holding a flask.
Coffee?
Please. He poured Mabbutt a cup.
I apologize for last night, he said briskly. I was defending my territory.
He held the cup out to Mabbutt.
Maybe I've just grown cynical over the years. I assume everyone who wants to know more about me is out to stop me doing what I do. But you helped us yesterday, and the boys like you. So here's the deal. Instead of taking you to the station, I will give you Kumar and a car. He knows these tribal areas. He's Masira himself. Go with him, and you will at least have a chance to see the people we're fighting for, and what they're fighting against. Then, maybe we'll have something to talk about.
He drained his cup, and indicated the stocky figure of Kumar, who was loading Mabbutt's bag into the back of an old Land Cruiser.
Are you sure you can spare him?
Melville held out his hand.
Think of it as the first and last day of our new public relations department.
He laughed loudly and walked off to confer with the group of village elders. There was much grasping of hands and clasping of arms. It was as if something was in the wind. Mabbutt climbed into the Land Cruiser and settled himself beside Kumar, who was checking his rearview mirror. Kumar was a local with thick, long hair, a square and homely face, and broad features. Ahead of them, Melville climbed into another car with Mahesh and Kinesh. The headlight beams stabbed out, and they started to move, rumbling over the hard red clay past spectral groves of eucalyptus and mahua. As the first hint of light crept into the eastern sky, Mabbutt wondered how he could have done things differently, and if he had, whether he would now be travelling with Melville. After a half hour or so, Mabbutt was woken by the crackle of a radio. Kumar pulled a receiver towards him, and words were exchanged. Kumar nodded approvingly, replaced the receiver, and accelerated along a partly tarmacked road. Mabbutt looked to his left, just in time to see Melville's vehicle peel off, bounce up a dirt track, and disappear into the forest. He thought he saw Melville wave goodbye.
Where are they going?
Kumar ignored the question.
Mr. Melville says I am your guide now. There are many things he wants me to show you.
They made their way northwest, on gently rising ground which led deeper into the interior than Mabbutt had been before. This was a largely empty land, weathered rocks and scrubby bush, with the shadow of the hills away to the west. It was a landscape both serene and sinister. At the top of an incline, Kumar pointed out the remains of a mobile phone mast, destroyed by the Maoists a month before. They passed a police post, so heavily fortified it looked like something from a war zone. A few miles beyond that, stacks of concrete sleepers marked a wide strip of land from which the trees had been cleared, awaiting, Kumar explained, the go-ahead for a railway to the refinery. Then suddenly the car slowed, and he pointed excitedly into the distance.
That is my home.
Mabbutt could make out a misty, russet-brown ridge a few miles ahead. It looked much like any of the other low, wooded ranges that ran one after the other as far as the eye could see. After a few miles, the road narrowed, and the scrubby trees turned into woodland, which then turned into forest. Then they were out of the trees and onto a flat, cleared plain. They entered a small town at the junction of a road and a railway. At the far end of a crowded main street, they came to a long, high wall topped by coils of razor wire. Mabbutt glimpsed through the gates, a well-kept campus, and a sign proclaiming the Masoka Hills Agricultural College.
Why would anyone put razor wire around an agricultural college? Mabbott asked. Because Astromechs paid for it, Kumar replied, and they have many enemies. On the far side of the town, with the walls of the agricultural college still visible, they came to a small settlement of traditional low-thatched houses surrounded by smaller brick and concrete units with tin roofs. Kumar's family lived here. And Mabbott met his thin but sharp-eyed father, his quiet, shy sisters, and two or three children who followed his every move with increasing amusement. His mother, he said, had died in childbirth many years ago, and now his father had another wife. She was in the fields that day gathering rice for winnowing. They were a happy group, and Kumar proudly showed off his new friend.
"I tell them you love our land," he said with a grin.
His parents had lived up in the hills, but when the road was built and the interior opened up to industry, the missionaries came and converted his people from animism to Catholicism. In return for saying their Hail Marys, they now had a school, electricity, and new houses. They were the lucky ones, according to Kumar. Their land was safe from the mining, for the moment. It was the hottest time of the day, and Kumar suggested they stay overnight with his family. The next day he would take Mabbott to the hills. They would visit the villages of the remotest tribes, the ones most threatened by the mining. Kumar explained it would involve a long walk, so they would start early. The rest of the day was spent meeting relatives, a steady trickle of whom passed by to see the foreigner. In the late afternoon, they walked round the village. Mabbott was shown a freshly painted, tin-roofed building that doubled as a school and church. He met the man who owned the only television set in the village, which he generously set up in the middle of the main street every night. He inspected the new concrete buildings and had his shirts washed for him in the pond at the back of the houses. The people couldn't have been more friendly, but there was something sad about Kumar's village, Mabbott thought. Some spirit seemed to have gone out of it. The embarrassed giggling of the young when his father sang traditional songs, the T-shirts and jeans that the children wore, all gave the impression that an old way of life had lost its relevance. But Kumar clearly regarded what had happened to his village as a good thing, the perfect third way between assimilation and extinction. To him, contact with the outside world was acceptable as long as religion, rather than commerce, was the driver. In one generation, it had enabled him to realize opportunities he'd never have dreamt of. As they finished their evening meal and talked of the day, Kumar chided Mabbott.
"Why aren't you writing all these things down, Mr. Journalist?"
Mabbott felt guilty. He wasn't writing because he was far less certain about everything now. If Astromechs represented the wrong way, then what was the right way? To leave people who didn't want to change alone? To offer them some change, but not too much? Should the modern world tolerate ignorance, even if it was blissful ignorance? Mabbott promised Kumar that he was taking it all in and would write up his notes later. So, after the meal was cleared away, and with Kumar's family and friends gathered around him in the glow of the lamp, Mabbott reached into his bag, pulled out his notebook, and began to write. A look of deep disappointment crossed Kumar's face.
"You have no laptop?"
Early the next morning, they went into the town, parking the car up by the station.
"Now we walk."
Kumar had made it clear to Mabbott that white men in vehicles, indeed vehicles of any kind, would not be welcome in the village they were going to see. The Gyara tribe who lived in the hills were the most cut off from the outside world, and also the most threatened by the mining company's plans. If Mabbott and Kumar were to get access, they would have to approach as equals on foot. The village was 10 kilometres away. As they crossed the railway line and began the climb across scrubby grassland, small groups of men and women came down the path towards them. Some of the women were young, still girls, with coarse dark hair arranged in waves and combed outwards so that it resembled small black bonnets. Decorations abounded. Clips, pins, combs and small knives for cutting fruit were tucked into their hair, with small brass rings through ears and nostrils, and heavier, wider rings through pierced, stretched earlobes. Their arms bore fine patterned tattoos, and they were swathed in multicoloured saris and cotton wraps. Most carried goods in large woven baskets on their heads,
Two of the women, Mabbott noticed, were carrying babies as well. The women walked together, chatting as they went. The men, dressed in shorts and cheap shirts, carried axes and bundles of wood on their heads. They were all on their way to the market in town, Kumar told him, to sell things like fruit and firewood in exchange for dried fish, salt, oil, spices, wine, and tobacco. Kumar greeted these people in their dialect and passed on to Mabbott any information he gleaned. The pineapple harvest was good. They were sacrificing a buffalo in a nearby village, and much sago palm would be drunk. Three babies had been born in the last week. After a while, there were fewer people passing, and Mabbott and Kumar spoke less as the track began to climb steeply and the forest grew closer and thicker around them. The heat was building too, despite the cooling shade of the trees, and Mabbott frequently had to stop to get his breath back. There were rewards to be had. No noise, no cars, no electricity pylons or security fences. A pristine, sylvan world, with shafts of sunlight piercing the forest canopy, highlighting the yellow butterflies as they fluttered about the shallow streams. In occasional clearings, banana, pineapple and jackfruit trees grew, and sometimes there was pasture for goats and cows. They had been moving for almost 2 hours when they turned a corner. Ahead of them, where the slope flattened out, was the village they had been looking for. It wasn't fundamentally different from the tribal villages Mabbott had already seen, a rectangular layout, long low houses on either side of a central open area. But here, deep in the forest and high up the hill, there was a much greater feeling of isolation. Unlike the town, where they were outsiders to be exploited, this was very much the Gyara's land. This was their world, and theirs alone. Here, Mabbott had to adapt to their way of life, rather than the other way round. Kumar, too, seemed a little in awe. For quite some time he stood respectfully at the edge of the woods. Then, beckoning Mabbott to stay close to him, he walked slowly towards the houses. No sooner had they moved than a terrific din broke the silence. Half a dozen excitable, khaki-brown mongrels raced through the village and ranged themselves between the buildings and the two men, blocking their approach. Mabbott, who'd never been comfortable in any sort of dog-versus-man situation, hung back. Their arrival seemed to have the opposite effect on Kumar, who beamed at the line of panting jaws and thrashing tails, as if this were the invitation he needed. The dogs continued to bark, more for the sake of it than from any great sense of conviction, but they soon grew bored and scattered back to the other end of the village. An imperious black hen appeared from between the houses, her chicks scuttling along behind. A dusty bicycle leant against a pile of wood. At the centre of the open area was a neatly arranged group of stones. Mabbott pointed to it. Kumar nodded.
That is the place for sacrifices. The old villages still have them. They sacrifice a cow or a goat and scatter the blood to make the fields more fertile. Do you have sacrifices in your village?
Kumar smiled, almost shyly, and shook his head.
No, we don't have them anymore.
There was little or no movement from the houses, but as they walked by them, Kumar called out softly, and Mabbott could hear the odd, shy greeting in return. He became increasingly aware of faces peering back at him from beneath the beetle-browed roofs, mostly women and children, crouched together away from the heat of the day. Across the entrance to one house, two young girls lay stretched out, propped languidly on their elbows like odalisks. They were dressed in all sorts of finery, and returned Mabbott's gaze quite unselfconsciously. There were few men to be seen, apart from one old man who lay alone at the entrance of a house, his lean frame shaken every now and then by a hard, bronchial cough. There was an atmosphere of inertia, though even as the thought occurred to him, Mabbott realized this was his own interpretation, based on little more than the fact that they weren't getting up to shake hands or offer him tea and biscuits. They were certainly not listless. When Kumar talked to them, the children looked as bright and mischievous as children should be. A little girl, sitting on her mother's knee with three gold rings through each of her ears and a pin through her nose, examined Mabbott curiously. An older girl, her neck draped with strings of beads and metal necklaces, watched him warily out of the corner of her eye as she leant forward to shoo away the dogs. While Kumar was busy dispensing sweets to the children, Mabbutt peered into one of the front rooms. The ochre walls were delicately inscribed with dots and triangles and stick figures. There were similar markings around the smoothly carved doorways and on the beamed ceiling. He crawled inside. It was cool and dark and soothing, and Mabbutt felt comfortably enclosed as he squatted on the hard earth floor. Outside, the barking became more sporadic, but the coughing more persistent. He must have stayed in the room for some time, because when he emerged, blinking against the light, he found Kumar talking to a man he hadn't seen before. The latter was young and desperately thin, with a small round face and intense, close-set eyes.
"Mr. Keith," Kumar exclaimed, "this man will take us to the top of the hill, the sacred hill."
Mabbutt thought ahead, to the 10 kilometres already separating them from the vehicle. He was hot and hungry, and every muscle ached. But there was a look in Kumar's eye that brooked no refusal. He nodded, reached for his water bottle, and took a long drink. By the time he'd screwed the top back on, the other two had already set off. Mabbutt heaved on his backpack, and catching the eye of one woman, he raised his glance heavenwards. To his surprise, she laughed. They proceeded out of the village past orange and banana trees and a weathered timber frame on which strips of meat had been hung out to dry. The dog summoned up enough energy to yap and bound about at their departure, but once they were in among the trees, the silence of the forest returned, and with it the feeling that they were in an ageless world, free of any human context. There was only the faintest of tracks to follow, and as the cover thickened around them, it was clear that without their guide, they would have quickly become lost. They must have climbed for a half hour before the guide stopped and pointed ahead. Kumar stopped too, and pointed to the last few metres of the hill, which rose steeply to its crest. He turned and shouted back to Mabbutt, whose heart was thudding alarmingly.
"From here is where they mine!"
His indignation rang round the forest.
"All this!"
He raised his arms above his head and pulled them apart violently, as if tearing open a curtain.
"Gone!"
It was then that Mabbutt finally understood the magnitude of what would happen when Astromex came for their bauxite. Deliberately ripping 40 feet from the top of these secluded hills was almost unimaginable. From here, looking back the way they had come, down to the sleepy village 2 hours' walk away from the rest of the world, with its barking dogs and coughing man and smoke rising lazily from the fires, the scale of the potential destruction induced a sort of giddiness. Kumar set off after the guide, pushing towards the crest of the hill. Mabbutt looked up. Beyond him, more trees and then the open sky. He took a deep breath and started to scramble after them. When at last he reached the top, he found himself on a wide, flat plateau. The air was cooler here and a breeze was blowing. Behind him, as far as the eye could see, the hills rolled away in waves of brown and green. Apart from the odd plumes of smoke, there was nothing in the broad landscape to suggest human habitation. Then he heard Kumar calling, and reluctantly he set off, picking his way through the spiky bushes towards the other side of the hill. As he reached his two companions, he found Kumar looking intently out to the west through a pair of binoculars. He offered them to Mabbutt. But Mabbutt didn't need the glasses to see what lay on the far side of the mountain. The vast agglomeration of the Kalpra refinery sprawled across the valley floor. Whereas the prevalent natural geometry of the Masoka Hills was smooth and rounded, the refinery was all hard angles and straight lines. With its cluster of grey funnel-like smelters and gum-barrel chimney stacks, it resembled some hulking battleship, the power cables its moorings, and the sinuous outlines of the paddy fields, the water swirling around it. Kumar, voice raised against the wind, was pointing to one end of the complex, where the late afternoon sun glinted on two strips of water.
"This small one, see? That is ash pond, ash flurry from power plant. Big one is red mud pond, sodium hydroxide. Mr. Keith company say no leaks. Mr. Melville say many leaks. Into the streams and rivers. We say, you have poisoned us. They say, look, no one want to farm here, so we can take more land for our refinery.
The plant gave off a menacing sense of purpose, of ramped up energy. Mabbott knew about the terrific heat required to refine alumina, and the need to keep smelters such as these running 24 hours a day. What was the formula? 14,000 kilowatt hours and 1,400 tons of water for 1 ton of aluminium. And he counted 12 smelters down there.
Mr. Keith, look there, please.
Mabbott followed Kumar's outstretched arm to a forest of cranes and the half-finished smelter pods rising at the point nearest to the hill.
They're building more, you see. You know why? Because they believe they will soon take these hills. See that?
Mabbott could see it very well. Snaking away from the near side of the refinery was a steel-framed conveyor belt, as yet unused, heading up through the forest towards them, aimed straight at the Masoka Hills, like a serpent's tongue.
Can they be stopped? He shouted back to Kumar. Everyone talk. Everyone cry. Then everyone get given school or house or telephone. So everyone do nothing. Only one man on our side, Mr. Keith. Only one man Astromech's scared of now. You see?
Chapter 9. The night train to Bhubaneswar slowly gathered speed as it eased its way across the tracks at Kindara Junction and onto the line that led south. It was comprised of 20 dull green railway carriages, all of which had identical rows of open bunks running through them, stacked in threes on either side of a narrow gangway. Most passengers were already either asleep or preparing for bed. Occasionally there was a cry of a child, or a low muttering between relatives, as the last portions of food were shared out. At an open window at one end of the last coach but one, two people were very much awake. Keith Mabbott and Hamish Melville stood side by side, taking in the night air. Melville held an elegant leather-covered hip flask, filled, he said proudly, with the very best Indian whiskey. Every now and then they had to flatten themselves against the door, as large ladies in voluminous saris wafted by on the last toilet break before bed. 2 days had passed since Mabbott and Kumar had stood on the top of the Masoka Hills and seen the titanic industrial complex extending towards them. After the long, profoundly sad walk back down the hill and through the village, Mabbott had returned to Kumar's family home, and being barely able to move the next day, had sat beneath a spreading cassia tree, feeling like an ancient scribe, as he filled his notebook, while Kumar, the modern tribesman, made repeated calls on his mobile phone. Which was how Mabbott had first learnt of what came to be known as the Kalpra blockade. Apparently, on the night after they had returned from the sacred hill, a well-marshalled crowd of Masira Kidonga, Musa and Giara people had emerged from the forest in the dead of night and occupied the road in front of the Astromech plant at the precise moment when three vast turbines, intended to double production at the refinery, had arrived at the main gates. As the trailers approached, 1,000 people had sat down in front of them, blocking the road and forcing the vehicles to pull up, at which point lights had flooded the area and cameras had begun to record the scene. Astromech's security had been taken completely by surprise, and their accusations of violent and illegal protest were contradicted by the highly skillful, professionally shot footage that appeared on the internet within minutes. It was the largest mobilization of indigenous people ever seen in India.
And no one knows it was you.
Melville shrugged and smiled.
Only those who need to know.
But it was your idea.
It was Gandhi's idea, originally. We just brought it up to date.
Mabbott and Melville had met at Kindara Junction. Mabbott brought by Kumar and Melville by Kinesh. There had been emotional reunions followed by equally emotional leave-takings. Melville hugged the boys like some demented grandfather, and even Mabbott was given a warm embrace by Kumar as they climbed aboard. As the train pulled out of a long curve and began to gather speed, a rush of cool air flung Melville's thatch of grey hair this way and that, making him look like Moses about to part the Red Sea. He handed the flask to Mabbott.
Try it.
Mabbott grimaced as he took a sip. Not bad.
Amrit whiskey, distilled in Bangalore. You can get it in New York now.
He laughed.
It will help you sleep. And believe me, on this train you'll need all the help you can get.
Mabbott took another sip and handed the flask back to Melville. There were so many questions he wanted to ask. All those people you organized, tribes that don't even engage with each other, let alone the rest of the world.
Look, Kumar is a Masira. His family came from the hills. They used to chop wood and walk 10 km to sell it for charcoal. They'd never seen a white man till the missionaries arrived. He was brought up at the bottom of the food chain. Well, tell me, you've spent time with him. Is there anything you can do that he can't? Given the right opportunities, those who want to can achieve anything.
The train was racing now, swinging alarmingly. From somewhere beneath them, sparks flew off into the night. Melville pushed up the window until it was merely ajar.
So they do have to change? Asked Mabbott, grabbing at the door handle. The Masira and the Giara and all the others who live in those hills. Even if it's just to help them fight change.
Melville took a long drink, then paused for a moment's appreciation.
Put it this way. It's not their fault they live on top of all these resources, but they do. And those who want to get at the resources are never going to give up. Not while you and I need our phones and computers and cars and trains and aeroplanes. So yes, they need to change. Even if it's only to become aware of what's going on and find ways of dealing with it.
That village, Kumar showed me.
Below the sacred hill. Melville nodded.
Nakya Marund.
It was like a different world. A different pace of life. Completely different values from our own. I couldn't say if the people were happy or unhappy, but they seemed to be content. They've lived with the forest for 1,000 years, not as far as I could see, oppressing anyone or destroying the planet. Shouldn't we be learning something from them, rather than wanting to change them?
Forgive me, Keith, but you sound like someone who's just woken up from a very long sleep. I've been working in these places with people like the Giara since I left the city. That's 35 years ago now. And everywhere the problem is the same. The modern world is closing in. It's inescapable and very hard to resist. Now, in Kumar's case, that's not his real name, of course.
No?
Melville shook his head.
He's been in quite a lot of trouble. A bit of a hothead until I got hold of him. But in Kumar's case, the missionaries got to his village before the bulldozers did. So, now they have more options. The people you saw living below the hill don't have to say their Hail Marys or live with trucks rolling by on a brand new road. But they have very few other options. If some minister in Delhi allows Astromechs to strip mine, there's not a great deal they can do about it. They can either move out to government accommodation, or wait one morning to the sound of men shouting, trees falling, children yelling, and bulldozers tearing their sacred hill to pieces.
Mabbott opened his mouth, but Melville raised a hand.
Don't say it. It's obscene. Everyone who comes here, everyone who hears about it for the first time, says it's obscene. Unfortunately, that doesn't help the Giara. They don't have a word for obscene, nor do they have a blog or a Facebook page. If the worst comes to the worst, they will simply have to do as they're told. They are powerless.
He handed the flask to Mabbott, who held it, without drinking. I thought that was why you were here. To save people like that.
Keith, you're the same as everyone who cares about these things. You go from indignation to despair in one bound. There is a way to help the powerless, and that is to give them power. That's what we do. That's what last night was all about. Astromex has huge resources, massive funds, and an international PR machine. What they don't have is the culture of the hill tribes. They've forgotten that the ancestors of these people have fought against bastards like them many times before. They fought off the British Raj and they fought off the Indian Rajas. Independence is in their genes.
Mabbott was thrown forward as the train gave a violent lurch. The lights went off and came on again. Melville hardly seemed to notice.
So that's the first thing we can use to our advantage. The Gaiara and the Masira may not want to live together, but neither wants anyone else moving into these hills. That's a force we can use. Something my guys, people like Kinesh and Mahesh, instinctively understand and can use to mobilize people. The other thing to remember is that to survive the way they have done, the Adivasi have had to be resourceful. These are not stupid people. Like Kumar, they learn fast. This gives them the advantage of surprise when dealing with people who dismiss them because they didn't go to college. So let outsiders think they're stupid. We can use that, too.
The train braked sharply, shuddering as wheels ground against rail. Mabbott lost his balance again and found himself clinging to his companion.
Do you think they can still win?
Mabbott asked, recovering his balance.
In this scenario, nobody wins. But I think there's a real chance they could limit the damage, and a real chance that their land might be saved. And don't forget, one success gives heart to a hell of a lot of people. The ripple effect. But do I think they can live cut off from the modern world? Sad to say, Keith, I don't.
The train had come to a halt. Mabbott could see a red light and hear the hum of the engines up ahead. Melville straightened up, stretching his arms above his head until they touched the roof of the carriage. He yawned mightily and shook his head from side to side. For some reason, Mabbott was reminded of a lion after a kill.
Now, I think, time for bed.
Mabbott wasn't tired. There was too much going through his mind. India, the children in the threatened village, the girls who had stared at him, Kumar's father singing, the fires in the forest, the dogs, the goons in their SUVs. He hadn't expected it all to affect him quite as much. His reflections were interrupted by a shout from the track. The signal changed to amber, and the train began to move arthritically. As it gathered pace, the squeaking and squealing resolved themselves into a series of soothing rhythmic clicks. Lowering the window, Mabbott could see that they were crossing a bridge. Below them, a broad river shone brightly in the moonlight. He was elated that he'd found Melville, and was aware that he'd enjoyed extraordinarily privileged access. But the journalist in him still recognized that he still needed to find out more about the man, about his future plans, about his supporters and his seemingly unlimited funds, about his ability to move so swiftly and silently across the world. As the train clattered on through the night, he realized that if the fine details about his subject were still opaque, one thing was clear and unequivocal. What he'd seen in the Masoka Hills had aroused an indignation that Mabbott thought he'd grown out of long ago. The hack work he'd been involved in recently had made him immune to shock or surprise. He'd fallen for the spirit of consensus. Well, this was his chance to retrieve some of the anger that had once motivated him. Whatever Melville's decision about the book, Mabbott felt it was his duty to record everything he'd seen. He took out his notebook, balanced himself against the door, and began to scribble down as much as he could remember. On the bunk below him, Hamish Melville was spread out, the heavy, dark grey railway blanket barely covering half of his long, rangy body. He was fast asleep.
By the morning, the train was over an hour behind schedule, and the passengers, many of them families with young children, having washed, tidied away their bedding and drunk tea from the urn that passed for onboard catering, seemed resigned to another day that wasn't going to plan. Melville had risen early. He'd managed to find the only food on the train, two packets of salty biscuits, one of which he'd lobbed up to Mabbott's bunk, before retreating to the end of the carriage to make some calls. Mabbott had got used to this pattern, the convivial companion by night, the man of action in the morning. He would just have to be patient and hope that they'd have a few more nights together before he had to leave India. It was only when he and Melville were in the neutral territory of a crowded Bhubaneswar station that Mabbott realized he was going to have to be the one to raise the question of their meeting again. "Will you be going back to the Farhan?" he asked, as they marched in step up the long platform. Melville threw Mabbott a sideways look.
"You're not going to give up, are you?"
It was now or never.
That's up to you. I feel privileged to have seen what I've seen. I've enough material to write a book about you, though I'd never make a move without your say-so. And yes, if I'm honest, I think it could be a great book, especially if you wouldn't mind talking to me again.
Melville said nothing. He was looking ahead, scanning the crowd at the end of the platform. Finally, he turned to Mabbott.
Look, I've some people to see. Why don't we meet for dinner? Then you can ask me whatever you like.
Mabbott restrained an urge to hug the man.
7:30 at the Pearl Room? Everyone knows it.
They shook hands. See you then. Mabbott thought he saw an arm raise somewhere ahead of them, and Melville moved, surprisingly nimbly, past the oncoming crowd and disappeared through a side door into the shimmering sunshine. Mabbott had called ahead from the train and re-established contact with Farood, who sounded immensely relieved having last seen his client in a village run by the Maoists. He had booked Mabbott back into the Garden Hotel, and here Mabbott ordered a late breakfast, took a long shower and a leisurely shave, bundled up his filthy clothes, and sent them to the hotel laundry. Slowly, during the course of a long and lazy afternoon, he reoriented himself to the world he'd left behind the day he took the decision to visit the Hotel Fahan. He talked to Jay, left messages for Sam and Christina, and promised to accompany Farood to a half-dozen unmissable temples over the next few days. It was with a distinct hint of smugness that he picked up the phone to Ron Latham. Without giving away everything that had happened, he could sense that Latham was just the tiniest bit impressed. The initiative was no longer just with urgent books. Mabbott wrote up his notes, slept a little, and then, as if to complete his return to the modern world, he switched on CNN News. He was only half watching when his eye was caught by a breaking news strapline rolling along the bottom of the screen. He didn't catch it all the first time, so had to wait for unemployment figures, bank profits, a small earthquake and a shock test match result to roll by before it scrolled round again. But there it was, large as life, in one side, out the other. Kalpra sit-in, judge puts restraining order on bauxite mine. Selecting a crisp, clean shirt from those newly hung in his wardrobe, Mabbott dressed, slipped a voice recorder into his trouser pocket, and checking the clock one last time, made his way to the lift and down to reception.
The Pearl Room.
A slim, immaculately dressed young man looked up from his screen.
Good choice, sir. Shall I make a reservation?
Mabbott smiled politely.
It's all right. I'm expected.
Chapter 10.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Mabbott, but Mr. Melville has had to fly to Delhi. He sends you his apologies.
Even as he'd approached the restaurant, something hadn't felt quite right. For a start, the Pearl Room looked to be the sort of place from which Melville would normally run a mile. It was glamorous and high-profile, part of a luxury hotel chain. There had been elaborate security checks of his taxi's engine and interior, even before they'd reached the entrance. Ahead of him, a large white Mercedes had disgorged a group of silk-clad, sari-swirling women, who had chattered their way through a door held open for them by a tall, dignified Sikh, complete with turban and waxed moustache. This was corporate India. Jackets and ties were in evidence. Mabbott was shown to a table for two, where a homely, attractive, slightly plump Malaysian lady greeted him warmly.
My name is Wendy Liu. I work for Hamish. He asked me to make sure that you have everything you want.
She was small, middle-aged, and had an easy, maternal manner. But Mabbott had been unable to conceal his disappointment, and she seemed to pick up on this. She gestured to the place opposite her.
He said that you have worked hard, and you deserve the best meal in Bhubaneswar.
She looked around the room.
And this is the best, believe me. Some say it is the best cuisine on the entire East Coast.
Mabbott opened his mouth to say something, but she chattered on.
Their speciality is seafood. I hope you like seafood, Mr. Mabbott. A drink first? Maybe you like gin and tonic?
She giggled rather endearingly and indicated a half-full glass in front of her.
My poison, I'm afraid.
When will he be back? She summoned the wine waiter.
I shall have one more, please, Minu, and then that's it, and you must tell me that's it.
She wagged her finger coquettishly.
And for my companion?
I'll have a glass of champagne, please. Bangalore?
The elderly waiter bowed politely.
We don't serve Indian champagne here, sir.
Wendy Lou intervened.
A glass of your best French, Minu.
Certainly, Miss Lou, my pleasure.
Mabbott wanted to show that he was a bit put out about Melville, but Wendy Lou's almond eyes and playful smiles soon dissolved any resentment.
You like your Indian wines, then, Mr. Mabbott?
Mr. Melville gave me some tips.
Ah, of course. A week on the road with Hamish is an education, in many ways.
He must be a very happy man tonight.
We are all over the moon, she enthused,
before looking around the room and lowering her voice.
This is a major setback for Astromex, Mr. Mabbott. The first they have suffered.
Mabbott followed her eyes round the other tables. Their fellow diners didn't look like the sort of people who would be celebrating the Kalpra blockade. Most were rich Indians, though there was a sprinkling of white and pink faces. An Australian voice carried across the room, and at a nearby table two very large Americans, both with black bootlace ties, loomed over their Indian companions. What brought them here, to Bhubaneswar, Mabbott wondered, and hadn't he seen them before? Miss Lou leant across the table, spoke sotto voce.
Private security companies. Ah, they'll try to blame Kalpra on the Maoists, but they won't be able to. The Maoists could never have organized anything on this scale.
A glass of champagne arrived and was set down beside him. Mabbott felt better. This might be the enemy camp, but that made victory all the sweeter. He raised his glass.
I feel we should drink to Hamish.
Yes, indeed.
They clinked glasses and smiled at each other. How easily they seemed to get on together, Mabbott thought, as if they were old friends. Was this another example of Melville's people skills?
So, when will he be back?
He asked. Wendy Lou rolled the ice around her gin and tonic before returning his gaze.
He won't be coming back, Mr. Mabbott.
She reached into a bag on the seat beside her.
But he told me to give you this.
A sliver of pale grey light crept under the rim of his window shutter. Mabbott raised it gently and peered out. There was nothing much to see, just the merest intimation of morning. He lowered it again and checked the screen. Timed the destination, 3 hours 10 minutes. The nearest city was showing as Minsk. Mabbott had slept a little, but was now frustratingly wide awake. He felt in the bag by his feet and pulled out the package Miss Lou had given him. For the umpteenth time, he withdrew a small white envelope and unfolded the letter inside. It was handwritten, and on the top were the words Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Whitehall, crossed out.
Dear Keith, forgive me for being so flagrantly discourteous, but the verdict on Astromex, while great news for us all, is only a temporary reprieve, and I want to do everything I can to make it permanent. This involves calling in a lot of favours and making a lot of visits. I wish it were otherwise, and that I could settle down in one chair and one bed for more than a night. But believe me, this work is never done. And keeping one step ahead means always having a bag packed. It also means working under the radar. As I think I told you around one of our campfires, as soon as I become the story, then my work, not just here in India, but in all those other countries where communities are at risk from the Astromexes of this world, becomes much harder. Now to my point. I have spent many years fighting off the attentions of those who want the Melville story, and I have no regrets. My life will tell its own story one day. And there is still so much to do that I don't have the time to nostalgize. Is that a word? Should be. At the same time, I'm aware that public curiosity is stronger than ever. Wendy will tell you just how many television companies come barking at the door each year, and I know enough about these things to recognize that if you don't play ball, admiration eventually turns to suspicion, and suspicion to speculation. In short,
I think the time has come for a preemptive strike, and this is how it could work. You get your book. I collaborate with you exclusively, and in so doing I get everyone else who is sniffing about off my back. The two of us can use the book to highlight my work, which we both know is more relevant than my life. I can give you contact details for those closest to me, and I'll assure them that you're completely kosher. Wendy will give you information on the campaigns we've been engaged in, and I've enclosed a purely factual biography, which has some of the early personal stuff that I'm sure Mr. Latham will be looking for. All I ask is that you leave me to get on with my work, and that there be no attempt to involve me in the day-to-day research for the book, or in interviews of any kind. All contact must be through Wendy, who will pass on to me any serious queries or problems. I will fully understand if you choose not to go down this path, but I'm afraid it's the only thing I can offer while remaining true to what I do. We talked enough about the world as we see it for me to sense that we think the same way in many respects. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think we share a common desire for justice and truth. We identify with the weak rather than the strong. We believe, as a wise man once said, that there are no superior or inferior cultures. There are just cultures which satisfy the needs of their members in different ways. This is a message that seems self-evident, yet everywhere it is under threat, as each country and each religion seeks to promote its own interests at the expense of others. So, Keith, there is a risk on both sides. You must believe in me, and I must believe in you. It would be too much to say that together we can make the world a better place, but we can perhaps add a little to the sum of human understanding. I'm sure we will meet again sometime, but until you have completed your work, I'll leave you to it. It'll be better this way. We can be friends, but it's much better for both of us that the outside world shouldn't know this. So farewell, and good luck. Whatever happens, I've enjoyed our time together. And if all else fails, we could use you out here. No money, but job satisfaction guaranteed. Your friend, Hamish M.
There was no question in Mabbott's mind that he could now write the book. A book about a remarkable man. Remarkable for his achievements, certainly, but also for his modesty, his carelessness of reputation. Mabbott could show the rest of the world that these unfashionable talents were something not just to be celebrated, but emulated. It would be a handbook of how to make things better, how to change the world from the bottom up, how to do good without being a do-gooder. Such was the tide of positives on which he was riding that he took out his notebook and began to scribble down the opening lines. He paused and checked the flight map. They were approaching Warsaw. Part 3. Everything Else. Chapter 1. They had agreed on a delivery date of the end of April, which gave Mabbott marginally less than 6 months to complete the work Ron Latham had decided to call Melville, the real life of a legend. This came with the dangling carrot of £60,000 on delivery and another £60,000 if the book made it to publication. This in addition to the £60,000 Cilla had already secured for him on signature, most of which had gone towards repaying the last few years of household debts. Mabbott had never been a conspicuous spender, and the promise of financial abundance was as bewildering as it was welcome. It certainly improved his frame of mind as he sat down at the laptop and tried out the title for the first time. It also helped to assuage the sharp pang of guilt he felt as he cleared Albana away into a box, which he stowed in a bedroom cupboard where Christina had once kept her dresses. Though meeting Melville may have been something of an epiphany for Keith Mabbott, he knew that he owed it to his subject to remain clear-eyed and avoid the trap of sanctifying or sentimentalizing him. To remind himself of this, he found a photograph of Mother Teresa, which he stuck on the wall in front of him, and across which he drew a thick red line. He started by typing up the notes he'd taken in India, for this had to form the central core of the book. This was the seam of gold. This was what only he knew, and what only he could deliver. From here, there would be flashbacks to different parts of Melville's life. The more he investigated the contacts Melville had given him over the weeks that followed, the more convinced Mabbott became that this was the right approach. Interesting as the memories and anecdotes might be, none came as close to revealing the essential Melville as the information he had culled from his 10 days in India. Miles Cardish, a friend from Melville's school days, had been charming, telling stories of how the two of them got into frequent trouble as a result of Melville's devotion to practical jokes. Chamber pots on top of flagpoles, collapsible bicycles, glue on walking sticks. Cardish and his ailing wife had been quite surprised that such a persistent offender should end up saving the world. And no, they didn't see him much nowadays. Friends of the family up in Cumberland had not been as surprised by young Hamish's later career. They reminded Mabbott that Melville's parents had been members of the Humanist Association, and that he had been brought up in a passionately irreligious household. The only substantial contact had been a man called Charlie Murray, a friend of Melville's from his university days, still a bachelor at 70, who lived amid a neurotic art collection in a fourth-floor flat beside the Albert Hall. They talked over tea as the first snow of winter settled on Kensington Gardens. Charlie was a delight, a fine raconteur, full of keen insights. On many dark evenings, Mabbott replayed the recording he had made to remind himself of the essence of the young Hamish Melville.
I suppose I knew him as well as anyone, which is not saying much. Hamish was always a loner. We played a lot of sport at university. He was a half-blue in athletics and a very fine cricketer too. Could have played for his county, but as soon as he'd mastered something, he'd drop it. He tried for the Foreign Office, but didn't get in, so we both headed for banking. He worked for Casanova's for a while, did very well. He had a talent for cultivating the right client, usually foreigners. He'd go out and spend time with them, whereas most of his colleagues sat about in London having long lunches. He'd be off to Nicaragua or Swaziland or wherever his client lived. He preferred being abroad, I think. And he picked up languages just like that. Used to say that you only need to know 500 words to speak any language fluently. I suppose that's where it all started. He once told me he quite liked to have been a soldier if he hadn't had to kill anybody. I think it was the training and the discipline he admired. Extraordinary man. Doing what we all ought to be doing, eh?
It was Murray who told Mabbott about Melville's short, tragic marriage to a South African heiress called Zena Carlson. They had met in Kenya. She was very beautiful, but had a wild side. Their fights and arguments were famously fierce. They'd been together for only 2 years when she was killed in a plane crash on the Kenya-Tanzania border while trying to photograph the wildebeest migration.
He came home for a while and tried to pick up his old life, but he was never comfortable staying in one place. Then both parents died within a few years of each other, and that freed him to become this sort of international guru. Thing is, Hamish could do pretty much whatever he wanted, wherever he wanted. He was incredibly well-connected, but always hated the establishment. That's the thing.
Much of Mabbott's time was spent at various libraries and learned societies such as the Asiatic, the South American, and the Royal Geographical, getting himself up to speed on the world through which Melville moved so energetically. He'd become a regular on eco websites. Wendy Lou was helpful, checking and cross-checking all the facts and supplying information. There were opaque areas, apart from the stories about his short, sharp marriage to Zena Carlson. Mabbott could find disappointingly little evidence of women in Melville's life. Charlie Murray hinted at a healthy interest in the opposite sex, but not much more. One source mentioned rumours of a royal liaison, but the trail led nowhere. It had been equally difficult to unearth much detail as to how Melville financed his worldwide operations. Those who knew him gave the impression that he had never been short of funds. Mabbott had the names of some good contacts in the city, but this was the world of old money, where handshakes were more important than written records, and it was almost impossible to get enough material to use. When he had pressed Wendy Lou to ask Melville for more information on possible backers and supporters, she had assured him that Melville's costs were on a third world scale, and that those who worked for him were more interested in principle than price. One of Mabbott's own contacts in the financial world had, under the strictest confidence, spent many hours at company's house before concluding that if Melville had money, it wasn't in a UK account, which, for an international operator, living abroad for 11 months of the year, seemed more sensible than sinister. Even Rex, when asked, drew a blank on Melville's arrangements. For Mabbott, it was just good to be a journalist again, using his old skills to decode a challenging subject in a ridiculously short time, and by and large the book moved forward at a steady pace. And as he pursued his research into the real life of Melville, his own life began to take a clearer shape. Forced to confront someone else's motivations, he was better able to face his own. Self-defense was no longer eating away at his confidence. Pride, however tentative, was seeping back into his life. Christina seemed to notice this. For the first time in almost 2 years, she was the one who got in touch with him, rather than the other way round. They went together to the opening of Sam's new play. Initially, it seemed to confirm all his worst prejudices. The play was set in a prison and involved a group of gay men who were approaching the day of their release. But once Mabbott had got the central idea that none of them wanted to leave and that the action revolved around their various strategies for staying, he realized with considerable pleasure that his son had real talent for comedy, of all things. Jay was still with Shiraj. Whether it was through love or pity, or love and pity, he wasn't sure. But she spent most of her time with the boy, and Mabbott got on well enough with him. Shiraj was a serious character,